Hello.
Buongiorno.
Bonded giorno.
That sounds weird.
Bond. Buongiorno.
Oh, boy. It's good. It's good.
Yep. I mean, it is what it is.
That makes me want to say DiGiorno in the same cadence.
It's not pizza or delivery.
I haven't had a DiGiorno in probably 15 years.
I'm not sure exactly the last year that I had it or decade, but it has a chemically aftertaste to it from the rising agents that they use. I don't know. I don't enjoy the flavor of that.
I don't think even the last time I bought a grocery store frozen style bake-it-yourself pizza, I don't think it was a DiGiorno. I think there are other brands that I purchased instead.
Yes. There's one that has a cauliflower crust now.
Is that the Oprah one? You seen the commercials for the Oprah one?
Yeah. Well, see, there's one that's actually like a cauliflower crust where they use a high percentage of cauliflower, and then there's the Oprah one where they... kind of
it's half cauliflower.
Yeah. they cheat on that one a little bit.
Are they mixing half cauliflower dough with half regular dough? Like, is that a thing you can do?
I did not inspect what she's doing in that recipe exactly, or or the people who are licensing her name are doing, but if you're making cauliflower crust, there's a couple different ways. Like, you can use egg as a binder and you basically wind up with something that's kind of like an omelet, and I don't love that kind. And then there's another kind, which is the frozen one that I've bought before, which is they put some tapioca flour and some other, like, gluten-free, not necessarily super carby flours in. Because for some people, it's not just a gluten-free issue, it's a carb issue.
I was going to say, I've seen the recipes for, like, the keto pizzas, and it's like, sprinkle provolone cheese on a baking sheet and cook it until it is almost literally burnt and it's really hard, and then scrape that off and then make a pizza out of it. It's like, well, that doesn't sound super appealing.
It isn't. There is a refrigerated cauliflower crust thing you can get at Whole Foods, or at least the Whole Foods out here, that Jason's bought on occasion. And it is kind of that eggy texture, kind of like a thin omelet. And you put it back into the oven with your toppings on it until the cheese on the top has melted and browned. But by that point, you've kind of charred the perimeter of that. So you kind of have like a burnt omelet edge around the edge of your pizza, quote unquote.
There are a lot of things that, you know, I'm okay with having a... you know, a bit of a burnt edge flavor to them, you know, like roasted potatoes, even some vegetables. Like, I'm okay with that, but not if that's like just the default.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Burn your food. It's good for you.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, brown is flavor. Browning things is flavor, you know. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, any actual, like, charring of any kind was, oh, no, you burned it. But, like, you learn that you can develop flavors in certain things by charring them.
Yeah. I cooked some chicken today. Tried to make it brown.
I went to California Chicken Cafe today.
That's that, you've been to that place before?
Yes. It is a place that exists in California. But, at combo wrap. But, let's rap about this movie. Let's talk about 1997's Tomorrow Never Dies. The sequel to many other James Bond movies, but particularly the one we discussed last week, GoldenEye.
Yeah. I hate this movie, I'm sorry. I will endeavor to find some things to discuss that are positive-ish, but basically every piece of this movie is like stretched in the direction that I don't enjoy. Like, it's a little sillier and a little less coherent, and the gadgets are a little more single serving for the specific use in this particular plot, and then are never really used again. And I just, it's all of the stuff. It's already showing the major warning signs of the Brosnan movies to come.
Yeah. It's, well, This one, I would say, GoldenEye is a little bit more Sean Connery than Roger Moore. And this one is a lot more Roger Moore than Sean Connery.
That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, and it's interesting because Brosnan does seem like he has settled into the role better in this movie. He's got a little bit more of the, you know, like the swarthy class thing going on. Yeah, he wears some more suits in this movie, I think, than he did in GoldenEye. But at the same time, there's a lot of just... There's a lot of talking, a lot of reiterating things, and then just a lot of like really like made-for-TV movie style action where people are not really... You can see the action. You can see like the fake hits and the wire work and stuff, and it's not... I don't find myself suspending disbelief at almost any instance in this movie.
Okay.
Not
well,
to
I
be
mean...
a negative Nancy about the whole thing.
I don't suspend my disbelief in any Bond movie because it's a James Bond movie. So I don't know if I agree with that criteria necessarily.
Sure. Maybe the human beings are the only things in Bond movies that occasionally get close to being realistic. But in this one, they're just like they're not really used very well.
No, I think I will agree. The dialogue in particular is cartoonish. To a degree that is not very good. There are some overarching ideas here that are kind of interesting, even from a modern day viewing standpoint, but it gets passed through kind of a poor 1997 writer lens of understanding of things that just doesn't quite deliver on what it could have been. 'Cause you have a... this idea that there is this media mogul who is big enough that he can control certain aspects of the media to influence the way that governments conduct their business, the way that news is covered, what is and is not a thing. Like, that isn't far-fetched, even by today's standards.
And there are movies that play on that theme, more on the theme of thing, you know, like hackers doing stuff rather than like, I'm going to go steal a ballistic missile from a ship and then sink it and use it in a stealth boat kind of thing. But same sort of principle, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, his actual like plan is really stupid. But the motivations of that are behind the villain in this makes sense. And that was one of those things that I didn't really love about GoldenEye was that what motivated 006 didn't seem super clear. Like,
it was just revenge and, you know, burning the world down. Although in this movie, you know, the guy having like national media rights or whatever, like, you know, you can go with him and say like, yeah, I get it that he's going to sort of control the media for the entire world and he'll use that to his financial gain or whatever. But you just kind of sense that, like, wouldn't at some point, if he's this power hungry, wouldn't he go for like personally overthrowing some particular country that he can run and like do the same sort of thing from that helm? I don't know. But you know, he just wants to be control the world's news guy, and I don't super love that character. Like, his plot I think would fit in if he was, you know, like the head of a rogue country doing bad things.
I think it makes more sense for him as a media mogul because he doesn't see himself as the politician who has to answer to people. Like, in this role he's the kingmaker, and so he can just say what he wants to say without answering to anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Pay me and I'll run the stories you want or not run the stories you don't want kind of thing. He hints at that at his party, which is very not subtle and probably illegal, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's very loosely based on Rupert Murdoch, who is not generally considered a well-liked person and who has had problematic issues with, like, I don't know, tapping the phones of government officials and celebrities and all kinds of other illegal things. And he's not running for public office or trying to control a country directly himself. That is interesting. But he has just awful dialogue that's written in there where it's just like campy cartoon stuff that he says. Mm. And
then it doesn't help that he's surrounded by, like, all of the characters. Even the serious characters lose their credibility as serious characters when they're surrounded by people like Stamper and Dr. Kaufman and, to a certain degree, Terry Hatcher, and just these other characters that are just, like, buffoon cardboard cutouts, and they're all having, like, serious quippy dialogue back and forth. It's like, not only does this not elevate the stupid people, it brings down Pierce Brosnan and Jonathan Pryce's character.
Well, I really hate Dr. Kaufman. I think he might be the worst character in this film.
Yeah.
And that mostly comes down to the casting choice, I think.
Yeah.
Where they decided to go for comedy, like real hard into comedy. And that doesn't work with, you know.
It's like, we're going to have like quirky, well, you're going to have like a perverted assassin. Which direction do you want to go? Do you want to go like the German guy who has no feelings and just loves to torture, or do you want to go with the slightly unusual like Pink Panther character? It's like, well, they couldn't decide, so they did both. And it's like, well, you really should have just picked one. And usually the one they go with is you know, the emotionless German guy who apparently can take a knife to the chest and not feel it because he loves torture so much.
Yeah, well, and you put him in you put Dr. Kaufman in contrast with Stamper, and it's like, these are not even remotely similar people. Like,
well, you know, he was like a father to Stamper. you wonder what those conversations were like.
But you don't really get a sense of that. They don't share a scene at mm-hmm. all, and it would be weird if they did, because one of them is actually German and the other one is Italian American, and is putting on an affected German accent for his role, which is not convincing. You know, he's a famous character actor. He just was completely miscast for this role, and he's not threatening as a result, because he's a comedy. He's a buffoon. He has a whole
he's
thing
got
where
a very
he
very sympathetic face in general.
Yeah, but he has the whole thing where he's like, I'm sorry, I'm so embarrassed. I have to, you know, ask you to unlock your car, blah, blah, blah. I could shoot you from Stuttgart, etc. It's just like all kinds of just silliness. Like, he's he's supposed to be threatening, and he's the person who
killed. He knows he's a Bond villain. He's not the good guy in his own story.
No, but he's not even a Bond villain. He's a dinky henchman. And he's the one
who's a smart villain.
He's the one who killed Terry Hatcher, and we're supposed to be feeling, technically we're supposed to be feeling, we don't, but we're supposed to be feeling something about Terry Hatcher's death in that scene where Kaufman is introduced. We haven't even seen him before, and we won't see him after, but he gets mentioned a couple other times, and it's such an odd, tonally weird thing to do. But in terms of Terry Hatcher, also a weird casting choice. Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman was a big hit at the time. And so she's there.
That was the one with Dean Cain, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 But like, that was her claim to fame. And then she did this, and then she did Desperate Housewives. And then I don't know what else she did in her career. She's not, I don't find her a compelling actress, in several contexts, including this one, where I don't...
You're like Terry Hatcher at all in any circumstance?
I'm struggling to think of any circumstance where I've enjoyed Terry Hatcher's performance.
Yeah, usually, I'm scrolling.
Usually she's fine, and I think in some moments in this she's fine, but then there's
stuff... What about Seinfeld? Do you like her on Seinfeld?
I don't even remember where she was on Seinfeld.
She's the real and the spectacular girl.
Oh.
That's all.
Okay. But I don't know. I don't find the chemistry between the two of them convincing, even though it seems like Pierce Brosnan's really trying, especially with kissing the dead Terry Hatcher. But
they have a more intimate connection when she's dead.
Yeah, and the whole thing with Carver, and it's just like, oh, I don't know him. Yes, he was just, you know, a roommate when I was in Zurich. And it's just
makes
like,
no
what?
Sense.
Yeah, she's not given great dialogue, but she also doesn't deliver it in a convincing manner. I know she's supposed to, like, there is a line in the dialogue where her husband, Elliot Carver, calls her a terrible liar. And the thing with that is she doesn't need to act being a terrible liar. She could have just lied, and then we as the audience would have believed that she's a terrible liar, because it would seem like a more subtle reading of her character, as opposed to we can literally tell that she's not telling the truth because she's just not behaving like a human being would if they were just saying that straight out truthfully.
No, but the bigger point is she has no motivation to lie. Like there's no reason she should lie. If anything, telling her psychotic boyfriend that her ex-boyfriend is a spy and he's in the party and you should watch out for him would be better for her.
Yeah, but she seems to struggle with some affection that she still has for mm-hmm. James Bond and doesn't want harm to come to him, except that literally harm will come to him. And they also have this whole dumb thing of like, you know, I was wondering who Elliot would send, and, you know, it was you. And after
somebody wrote that scene and then tried to retrofit it to everything else.
Yeah, but if Elliot knew that this was his, if this was his hotel, and Terry Hatcher knew, and she came there, then wouldn't it follow that leaving Terry Hatcher in the hotel room would not be an entirely safe plan?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, so it's just silly, dumb stuff, but whatever. She's not in much of the movie. The more important person in this is Michelle Yeoh, who plays Wei Lin, who is a colonel and a Chinese, what is it, external defense something. She's basically what James Bond does in the Chinese government. She at first is not playing a romantic interest. She's just, you know, flirty or whatever. But she shows that she has some competence, especially in physical hand-to-hand combat, more so than James Bond does, where he's mainly just going to, like, trick you into trying to light a cigarette and then punch you in the face.
Yeah, her defense mechanisms come with wires.
Yes. It was a good pairing, and it was something unusual that they hadn't done in James Bond movies prior to this, where she's really almost or his equal or almost his equal in most contexts. She's smart and capable. There's a scene where they're grabbing that pin to throw up into the helicopter, and they just look at each other and they look at the pin and they know what to do, and they don't have to exchange dialogue with one of them telling the other one what they're doing. So it allows you to put them on equal footing, and it's handled pretty well for the most part. So I like her, and I like Michelle Yeoh, in other things. I don't know if necessarily she works for everyone, because her performance is that she's a spy, but there's also kind of like a language barrier because she's delivering the James Bond dialogue, like, but it's weird,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Also,
but I like her. I really like her.
It's good that they have, you know, the spy language in common and stuff, but they don't have a ton of conflict between the two of them. I mean, like, that's another Bond trope where, like, there are two people pursuing the same goal but by different methods, and they sort of like undercut each other along the way. And aside from the fact that they're like arguing over who's gonna control what part of the motorcycle while they're riding, like, they never really get in each other's way and like have to, you know, work through their differences together. So it parts of it just kind of feel like he's talking to himself, and it just happens to be this lady spy that's with him.
She undercuts him when she takes the handcuff off of her and then handcuffs him to the shower thing.
Sure, but then he's like, oh no, and then just yanks and breaks the pipe, and then, yeah, you know, that person's water bill is like $400 that month.
Yeah, and then they bicker over, you know, who's sending a message and who's getting the guns and stuff. It is nice that they can trust each other in some regards, and they're not immediately trustworthy of one another. their first meeting where they understand that one another is a spy working for the other government is when she is breaking into the upper office building and triggers the alarm. And they don't work together from that point on or anything like that. They're still opposed to one another until they rendezvous again at the ruins of the Devonshire underwater. So they work
so
together.
Stupid.
Well, I mean, it's not an ideal place to meet somebody, that's for sure.
I mean, like, they do the big whole thing where he halo jumps in from the plane, and then he swims down in through the hole, and then he just turns around and she's there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, continue with your point, sorry.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, for character stuff, like, I think that there is sufficient friction initially between the two of them, and that they get along and seem competent and work well together towards the end. It's not necessarily like spy versus spy, but I don't think it should be. Then your other ancillary characters, you have Gotsado as Stamper, who is just the 1990s version of Jaws.
He's that guy that has silly looking torture mechanisms in a glass box.
Well, technically they were Dr. Kaufman's, but he's got peroxide hair, and he...
That's how you know he's German.
And he's very tall, and he likes to beat the crap out of people, and if you stab him and stuff, he's generally going to be okay, and seem to almost enjoy it, which is a little weird. But he's just your standard James Bond henchman. There's not a lot of depth to him, or what motivates him, or anything really interesting about him. He just has more dialogue than Jaws does, so that's something. You have the return of Joe Don Baker as Jack Wade, the CIA liaison. He's got a fun Hawaiian print shirt, and he's charming, but doesn't do anything again. So yay, I guess. And
yeah, he's there. It's like they're trying to set up some sort of Felix Leiter character for him to be pals with, but like it doesn't work because he just has like three dumb American lines in two movies and then that's it.
And you get your Henry Gupta, the evil hippie druggy porn aficionado guy. I don't know.
The what?
Well, did you see the dirty magazines that were in his safe? In his office?
I guess, yeah, that was his safe?
Yes, when he was going to go get the GPS encoder, James Bond opens up the safe, and it's dirty magazines, some bags with white powder in them, and some
syringes.
Needles. Yeah.
I love that he picks up the syringe first to look at it, like, it's a syringe, put that down. Also, why is the syringe in the safe?
Yeah. Why is any of that in the same? I mean, other than the GPS encoder, like, what? Why would he lock up any of the other stuff?
His company has a no heroin at work policy.
They're very bad at enforcing that. But he's played by close-up magic artist Ricky Jay, who died this last year and was excluded from the Oscars in memoriam segment. So, good job, everybody. But he's not a good actor, and he doesn't do any magic, but he's here.
I mean, he's fine enough. He's no worse than some of these other bit character roles.
No, and I mean, he just has the dialogue to deliver, like, oh, I typed in the thing, and then I did this, and here's the 9-minute countdown. Look at me holding a tiny personal computer. It is running Windows CE, probably.
He knows how to keep his face casual.
Very casual. And then you have the other ancillary characters. You have M, returning Judi Dench.
Who is in the beginning of the movie and then disappears until the very end. As soon as I found myself wondering, like, hey, what happened to M? There's like a quick scene of her like walking briskly down a hallway, and then it cuts away from her, and you don't see her again for like another 10 minutes until the end of the movie. It's like, oh, and by the way, M is still here.
Well, she didn't have much to do in GoldenEye either. Generally, M doesn't do much. They use M to set up things.
She usually defends Bond to the other government folks, and then in private sort of chastises him, but she never really gets the opportunity to do the private conversation with him in this movie.
No.
Am I correct that they don't actually have any scenes together in this movie?
They do have, at the beginning, when they are in the little motorcade, zipping around through London.
Oh, right, when they're in the weird Rolls Royce, and James Bond's making weird sexual jokes at Moneypenny.
Yeah, and when he walked in with the newspaper and presents it to the Admiral dude, mm-hmm. and everybody, they're all there. M, as a character, just does not typically do much in the Bond series, but...
Until you get to some of the later movies.
Yes, like the movie after this, notably. Unfortunately,
which one's after this?
The World Is Not Enough.
Which is the diamond one?
Nope. You keep saying that, but...
The World Is Not Enough is... who's the bad guy in that one?
The guy who has a bullet slowly going through his head and...
Oh, sweet Jesus, that
yeah,
guy.
Yeah. There's yeah, the sub.
Radiation Radiohead guy.
Yeah.
That movie sucks. And it's the other thing about this movie, just in general, is it's only 2 years after GoldenEye, but does it not feel like a good 5-6 years after GoldenEye?
Not really. In what way?
I don't know. Maybe it's the way Brosnan is kind of directed, but he already seems like he's slowing down between the two movies.
Oh. I don't know. I didn't really feel that.
I mean, in terms of the Roger Moore-ification, when I think of the Roger Moore effect on movies, I think of a guy who's a little too old for his role, who's going to do some very dubious judo chop to people's necks, and then just kind of like look nice in a suit, which I think this movie has more of than GoldenEye.
He's doing a lot of hand-to-hand combat and stuff in here.
Yeah, in some instances, but there are other instances where, and maybe it's just the way it's shot, where it's just like it looks very, like they're going through the motions and kind of lackadaisical.
I don't know about that. There's also more action in this movie than in GoldenEye, but it's weirdly imbalanced in terms of where it's put in the movie.
And the end bit there too, when the ship is blowing up and he's doing all his stuff, like Brosnan's really going for it. The surroundings around him are kind of hilariously dumb, but he's really in the moment in those particular scenes. So I think he really committed to those. It's just some of the scenes along the way where it just feels like he's kind of like he's got one hand in his pocket and he's kind of like, well, I'm James Bond and I'm going to punch this one man and then jog over here.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, I think some of that is just. James Bond is not, until Daniel Craig, is not like a frenzied little whirling dervish of punching.
Just the way, all of the action movie stars these days are gigantic, buffed, ripped dudes. Back then, it was a little more chill between punching people in the face. People didn't have to backflip when you hit them.
Yeah, also, he's like on a street with people, so he's just sneaking up to the next guy, punching him in the face. But
although the on the street part where he does the fake lighting the cigarette and punches the guy, it's hilarious to me that like he's like, oh, I'm just the only white person walking down the street. I'm totally gonna blend in and totally look casual.
The only white person with his shirt unbuttoned down to the middle of his chest, that's also partially soaking wet, and is just gonna walk up to you and light your cigarette.
Part of James Bond's like charisma is the fact that he always looks casual and comfortable and like he belongs in every situation. But in this particular instance, he should know that tactically he sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yes, tactically unsound. But
tactically unsound. Tactically unbuttoned.
But the other notable actors in here, the introduction of Colin Salmon as Robinson, the M's deputy chief of staff. We get Samantha Bond returning again as Miss Moneypenny. So we get a couple other people, and we get, Desmond Llewellyn, this is his last Bond movie where he is the sole intelligence guy. In the next movie, they start to do the handoff to John Cleese.
I like that he's disguised as an Avis rent-a-car guy in this one. It's minorly humorous.
It's pretty funny. So let's quickly walk through the plot now that we've established our feelings on these characters, because there's not much to really talk about, because we have an arms dealing situation at the beginning where some reactionary, bloodthirsty Admiral guy wants to blow up the arms thing.
It's very similar to the cold open of GoldenEye, except, you know, there's jets instead of prop planes and there's big missiles and stuff.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they shot it somewhere near there, because isn't this probably also the Italian Alps or Swiss Alps or something, probably?
Probably.
It's every time they go to Russia, for some reason, it's always snowy mountains.
I was looking at the Wikipedia page just briefly, looking at the production section. They're like, they had planned to shoot this in one place, but permits were difficult, so they just went to another place they had shot Bond movies before and knew weren't going to be an issue. So I would not be in the least bit surprised if they're just like, let's just go to the places we know.
Yes. And it's fine. It's a strange credulity that the Russian guy who's there talking to them in the horrible fake Russian accent is like, yeah, sure, just blow up all of these people at a thing. You know, we can't be bothered because you know, we're having an election, which seems silly in hindsight. But
the fact that the American guy is like, do what the Russian dude said, blow him up.
What American guy?
Oh, sorry, the British guy.
Yes.
Admiral, whatever.
The Admiral. So they launch a missile, and you get a very exciting CG missile shot we keep cutting back to. There's some helicopter footage.
You know, I've seen worse smoke, but not a lot.
Well, it was 1997, Dan. But
kind of a little bit of slack on their particle sims. They really needed to save some time on the render farm.
But the one really nice thing about this opening is it really establishes David Arnold's scoring for the Bond series going forwards. And
is that what it does?
I like the music that's scoring this part. If you don't, you can rot in hell, but that's just, you know, a respectful difference of opinion.
this might be one of those movies where you love it and I just don't notice it, really.
Oh, man. It is jazzy, brassy John Barry-ness, like, but slightly more up to date for the 90s. And he would continue to score these up to Casino Royale was his last one. And then because what's his face, Mendez, liked working with Thomas Newman, that's why Thomas Newman did the Skyfall and other stuff. But David Arnold did all of them from here until Casino Royale, including Casino Royale. But it's got all the jazzy stuff. It's got the James Bond theme. It doesn't have any of the weird, bizarre Eric Serra stuff.
The 90s techno coffee shop music?
Yeah, well, it has 90s techno. Like, there's a lot of drum and bass, but it's not the like, I don't know, plinky weird game show music that was in the other one. They have this tense scene of them trying to, of James Bond trying to get this MiG out of there that has a nuclear torpedo before the missile can hit them, because the missile can't be aborted.
Even though we've all come to know from other movies that that's not how nuclear bombs work. You can blow them up and they don't go nuclear.
No. Well, what the Russian guy says is that, you know, even if it doesn't, then it'll be enough plutonium spread around to make Chernobyl look like a picnic, which is hilarious.
Chernobyl really does look like a picnic most of the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know what's weird? Have you ever looked at the photos of what Chernobyl looks like now?
Yeah, it's very grassy.
Yeah, it's very interesting looking.
They also put the big dome over it, so it's probably a little less horrifying right now. Mm. We'll see. We'll see when Craig Mazin's show comes out what they do with it.
Wait, what?
Craig Mazin from Script Notes wrote a show called Chernobyl.
Oh, dear.
For, I think it's HBO or Netflix. It's coming out this year.
No. Can't wait for him to be angry at people who don't love it. They get the MiG.
The term is umbrage.
But they get the MiG out of there, and then there's another MiG, but this one's red.
You know, by the way, I would just like, before we get email, we don't get email, I would like to correct the record that I too thought it was a MiG, but it's apparently called a J-7 fighter jet.
Excuse me? Oh.
It's Chinese version of a Soviet MiG.
Okay. In the movie,
Wikipedia.
In the movie, they say Mig.
Well, Wikipedia stands differ.
I don't think they actually shot with a Soviet MiG, especially since the Soviet Union didn't exist at the time.
So
but
he steals an L-39 Albatross and is chased by a J-7 fighter jet. So it's a Czechoslovakian jet.
Are we sure about all of this?
No, I'm not sure. I'm just telling you what Wikipedia says.
Okay. Well, they say MiG in the movie. But anyway, they get out of there. And then he's garroted by the guy he knocked out in the back.
Who just happened to have, like, a giant zip tie in his pocket or something.
Yeah. It's a fighter cockpit. It's just full of loose cabling. And mm-hmm.
Or he just took the lace off his boot.
Sure. We don't actually see a scene of that happening, nor do I need to see it. But he's trying to dodge the other plane, and so they make the plane fly all wobbly because he's garroted. And then he gets underneath the bad plane and then pushes the ejector seat button, which doesn't pull the garrote to rip off his own head for some reason, but sends the other guy into the bottom of the plane above him, and then it explodes.
That part's fun in a bit of in a James Bondy way.
Yeah, and then he says, you know, ask the admiral where he would like his torpedo.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut to Sheryl Crow.
Sheryl Crow. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of Sheryl Crow in my day, but I did not remember that was Sheryl Crow.
It's not a good one. I would say that someone made a mistake. Because, you see, the music that plays over the end credits for this, with Katie Lang singing it, it's called Surrender on the soundtrack, if you look for it, because Surrender is one of the other things that she says. But you'll notice that it seems more like the kind of opening music that you would get in a James Bond movie, and that's because it was supposed to be, until it was replaced late in the production by the producers who wanted to capitalize on Sheryl Crow's rising stardom, fame, whatever. And so they had this Sheryl Crow version put together for the beginning of the movie. And it also sounds very different from the rest of it, whereas the Surrender, quote-unquote, the end title credits, quote from the score, because David Arnold participated in that. But no, this Sheryl Crow thing sucks. These are titles, again, by Kleiman, who did the GoldenEye titles. There's more computer graphics in this, a lot, and some questionable choices. But they do some visually interesting things for James Bond opening. I don't know why there's x-ray stuff that doesn't seem to link to anything in the plot, but
no, it's just kind of cool looking.
There's some x-ray things. There's computer circuit lady people who are very reminiscent of Pierce Brosnan's other movie, Lawnmower Man, and they walk around
it.
You didn't see Lawnmower Man?
Mm-mm. I may have seen it a million years ago, but no, I don't think I've seen it.
It's very unpleasant looking. There's these sort of CRT lenses that pass by things and show the other world, which basically consists of naked ladies. Then for some reason, there's a diamond necklace that turns into satellites and someone does a high dive off of a diamond. The diamonds as satellites, okay, fine. It's a little bit of a stretch. Satellites, again, an important plot point, but it's a little silly.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Briefly an important plot point.
They go from that to the Devonshire. They're Chinese MiGs telling them that they're in the wrong spot. And they're like, no, GPS definitely says we're in the right spot. Flashback to the weapons thing where Henry Gupta was getting a GPS encoder. So anyway, they...
GPS never lies.
No, never. Never, never. And then we reveal the stealth boat. There's a lot of day for night photography here. and I think that's one of those things that I don't appreciate much in movies is day for night photography. But they get the stealth boat up close, and the guy in charge of this mission explains the mission to everybody on the boat because they obviously have never heard it before, like we haven't heard it in the audience.
I think we hear most of the important plot points at least two times in this movie.
Yeah, the sea drill is going to be dropped when the MiGs fly by, so it'll look like the MiG dropped a torpedo in the water. Then the sea drill is going to drill through the Devonshire, sinking it. They're going to kill everybody on the boat, and then they're going to send divers into the Devonshire to recover one cruise missile. This is weird, because if you could get weapons like this, and it seemingly you can, why do you need to do this? I don't know. They have other missiles.
I mean, they would probably say it has to look like a British missile that hits, so they can make sure it's the Brits. In the same way that they gunned down the sailors floating in the ocean with a Chinese machine gun.
Yeah, except when a missile explodes, there aren't like ammunition shells to go check afterwards.
there might be some rubble, some bits.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's not going to be a lot of dental records when that thing goes off. But this is the plan. So they get it and they call up on the video teleconference to Elliot Carver's giant theater in Hamburg, where he is typing, quote unquote, on his little wireless keyboard.
I love the scene in Saigon where he's typing one-handed furiously on his wireless keyboard.
Yes,
and he does a good job of selling it, but nobody has ever typed like that coherently.
No, he doesn't sell it. He's just smacking his fingers around on it.
He's typing better than like Farva did in Super Troopers.
Yeah, but if you're typing on something, you need to keep your fingers like in the same relative location, so you have a spatial sense of where things are without looking. What he does is he just moves his fingers around all over the place constantly, so it's not typing. But anyway, he tells, you know, Stamper to let him know how many survivors there were. Of course, they kill them, and he enters it into his headline that British sailors murdered, not killed,
14 of them.
Yes.
There's a point where you can't. You got to stop nitpicking certain plot elements in James Bond movies, because they're James Bond movies and they're just going to have those sorts of things. Like the GoldenEye satellite, I think strains credulity, but it works to a point, because you're like, okay, EMP, I know what that does. Maybe there's a way you could fire that in a targeted manner from a satellite. Probably not, but you know, I get it. In this movie, there's a sea going drill with three blades that looks like the monsters from the Langoliers that's going to drill a hole through a boat and then be able to like navigate up, down, left, right through the different parts of the ship to like go make sure it's super duper wrecked and find stuff. And I don't want any of that.
I think the sea drill is one of those mechanisms that you have in a James Bond movie, while it's not the most effective or practical way for them to have sunk the Devonshire.
It's not particularly useful in really any way other than like an efficient way to sink a ship. But there are other ways to sink a boat.
Yeah, yeah. Mainly involving explosives. And maybe you could make the argument, oh no, they don't want explosives to potentially damage the missile. But if you're sending a giant triple-bladed drill thing all through there, like you don't know that you're not going to accidentally wreck it anyway.
And they were even talking about that too, like, you know, the crew of the Devonshire was like, he's like, and now they're wondering why there hasn't been an explosion. Joke's on them, because we have a drill and it's coming for them. And it's like, well, you wanted them to believe that the Chinese bombed them. I mean, I get that you're going to kill them, so it doesn't really matter, but like, why didn't you just like, you're so like attentive to the detail of using Chinese machine guns and using the appropriate missile and stuff, but you need the sea drill for that. Sure, cool, whatever. Somebody thought of the idea. They thought it would be cool. They really wanted to push a human being into it, even though no blood came out when that happened. But whatever, fine.
Well, that's because, you know, it's a James Bond movie. Like, there are far more ridiculous.
But can't James Bond aspire to be a better movie than that?
No, James Bond can't.
The spirit of James Bond mandates that there is some completely unrealistic, stupid thing there.
Yeah, well, it's just that it's these are just sort of the mechanisms and archetypes and cliches and whatever you want to phrase it as. Like, these are the way that James Bond movies are kind of put together. Now, to varying degrees of that, for sure.
I think GoldenEye did a much better job of it, and that's probably why I like it so much.
Yeah, I mean, it still has a helicopter that's shielded from EMP radiation. And
but, you know, the helicopter is a thing. Like, okay, this helicopter, you know helicopters. This is a special one. There are not, like, you've heard of sea drills that chase things down in the ocean. This is a special one that cuts through boats.
Here's our special satellite dish that we built in Cuba that is full of water, but we push a button and then all the water plays in reverse footage as
it's
drained out.
Well, it's a real satellite dish. It just, you know, it doesn't happen to, you know, elevate itself out of a lake.
Yeah. And, like, so there's silly stuff that can be found in any James Bond movie. That's for sure. But just to varying degrees. Like, this is not an underwater city. There is no fleet of space shuttles being sent into outer space to shoot lasers at each other in orbit around a space station.
Okay. So I just remembered the next thing I wanted to ask you about. So the thing that that also kind of bothers me about this movie is that his plot at the end of the movie is also kind of exactly the same thing he did at the beginning of the movie. Like, the, you know, attacking the British, making it look like the Chinese, attacking the Chinese, making it look like the British. He's going to do the same thing, but on a larger scale.
And yes.
It bothers me that they didn't, like, I don't know, find a different way to do that or something. I don't know. You know, you get what I'm saying here?
I don't understand your criticism, but I understand what you said.
The
sameness of it is bothering you?
The sameness, the fact that he, like, tests his ability, and now he's going to go demonstrate it on a larger stage, but he already did that, so it's like, I don't know. You're just going to
He's not using the sea drill on a larger stage. He's not sea drilling Beijing. He's sending the cruise missile to Beijing, and he has a whole complicated plan where General Chang is going to go take over as the new head of government, and then de-escalate the situation in his favor.
I think part of it is just, like, how many times can the bad guy pull the same gag before he gets caught? You would think he would know to, like, switch it up.
Well, there's a... I mean, it's twice, so I don't know if you can really establish a pattern if you're somebody who's observing the situation externally. And surely the British Navy and the Chinese Air Force would not have even looked for them at all had it not been for Bond and Wei Lin. So there's validity to that. One thing that doesn't make any sense is Carver's weird desire to have an audience and James Bond villain monologue a lot when he should just kill people. Because once, okay, fine. This is a James Bond movie. Twice, okay, it's not a great James Bond movie. Three times, are you kidding me? Like, at the end of this movie, let's see, he's in Hamburg. He has his security guards beat up James Bond to find out what he knows. Then he has Kaufman kill his wife and go after James Bond. And then he has the situation where they're in Saigon and he picks them up from the boat and drags them to his office in Saigon, and then he could kill them then before he dragged them to the office, and he didn't. And then they escape from the office, they rampage through the city, and then he meets them again when they get onto the boat. And instead of killing them outright again in that last time when they're on the boat, he's just like, no, this is chit chat. I like to have an audience, so let's just roll with it. And it's just like you can't do that convincingly three times where I'm supposed to believe that you're this incredibly stupid, because they've shown a pattern of getting out of everything that you've tried to use to restrain them, and they're incredibly dangerous to your plan and very near to your plan's main points of failure. But his hubris seems to be a main feature of Elliot Carver, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's also a little bit of a... They brush past it, hoping we don't really notice it well. But in terms of, like, nobody's going to notice the pattern of, like, them pulling the same gag twice. Like, they do notice the pattern where they're trying to figure out, like, where the stealth boat is. They're just doing some Googling, and they're like, oh, it's got to be this bay over here. There's been some random, unsolved drownings and things, so it's probably that. And it totally is that. So they use some sort of just, like, there's a lot of bad things happening in this small little area right here. Maybe we should go look there.
But they do, through the magic of editing, spare us them checking every cove, and they are coming to sunset, and they are rounding their way to
the
last cove.
They just, like, search the internet, and she's like, it's going to be over there.
No, but then they go on the little Zodiac, and they have dialogue between each other that they've been checking coves all day, right before the sun sets, and they're like, this is the last cove, hopefully it's here.
It's always in the last cove you look in, isn't it?
It is. Literally, in this case, we just didn't
actually. It comes around the corner towards them. They don't even have to, like, go check the final cove. It's like, here I am.
Yes, but my point is, it was not the first place they looked. It's just that we didn't see the other places they looked, so it just feels like it's the first place they looked.
And my point is, boo.
You're just in a sour mood. But
this movie has soured me.
It's not that I just don't understand. It's especially if you put it in the context of the other Pierce Brosnan films.
Oh no! The other ones after this. Well, maybe the thing is the ones after this are so bad that they're laughably bad, and this one still feels like it's trying to convince me that it's a good movie, and it's just really not.
Okay.
It's a transitional period from GoldenEye was good to we know these other movies are really bad. Like, you don't name a character Christmas Jones on accident. And, like, in between there, they're making the transition from GoldenEye to Christmas Jones. And it just happens to be they're like, you know, you can trust us with some stuff. There's some silly things, but you can trust us. We're still making movies that are good. And I'm like, nah, I don't. You got one hand in the trying to be nice and good, and you got one hand in the being silly, and you're making nobody happy.
I don't know. I mean, I'm happy. You just
I am not happy. Be stupider, yeah. Movie. Like, give me an invisible Aston Martin that can climb walls, and I will laugh along with you. But in this movie, you give me a sea drill, and nobody's laughing, and I'm like, this isn't funny.
But they save all the yuck-em-ups for the dialogue, Dan.
God, there's so many stupid. There are many puns. Quips. A lot of them just go like, they fall on deaf ears.
A lot of puns and innuendos. I mean, it's a James Bond movie, so.
It's got to have that dialogue, but.
But like I said, the bad guy dialogue is not sparkling. They recover the missile, back in London. They're trying to figure out how to, have their forces go against each other. James Bond is brushing up on a little Danish up in Oxford. But then he races back to town in 30 minutes, I guess. But he picks up the newspaper and points out that this thing is happening. And then Private says, I didn't want to say this in front of everybody else, but we are investigating Elliot Carver, who owns that newspaper. Because he's a media mogul, and James Bond is like, yes, I know he's a media mogul. Now let me explain to you how I know that he's a media mogul, and he's able to topple governments with a single broadcast, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bad dialogue. And then I don't know how they filmed this scene without getting carsick, because they just did circles around London, apparently. But they drove along in the motorcade till he gets his paperwork, and he goes to Hamburg. He lands, goes through the airport, and rendezvous at the Avis station with Q, who has a delightful red blazer, as we've already mentioned. And then they go check out his new BMW 750i.
But I've never rented a car that comes in a crate like that.
No. Well, I get the sense that it was shipped somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But
it's not really how they ship. Cars,
no,
it's fine.
No, it seems like it would just like bounce around inside the box and be destroyed. But the unique feature of this 750i is that it has remote control from his Ericsson telephone.
So it wasn't even Sony Ericsson back then, right? This was pre-merger.
Yeah. Yep. This is back when Ericsson was still making their own stuff, and So the foam splits apart. It's a candy bar shape, with all the buttons and stuff on the front and a little spinach green screen. It has a little security thing, which comes into play at a couple points. I don't know how it has a battery that can store enough juice for any of this, but, you know, I guess it's just a lower power processor back in the 90s. You flip it open, you get the video from the front of the BMW, apparently, and you drag your finger across the touchpad, and there's several buttons around it. This looked like the coolest thing when I was a kid. I was very excited by all of this. This is not how this phone actually worked. This is not a good phone. No one should own it. No one should buy it. But this is how product placement works with James Bond.
You can't buy one like a talk boy and like go around scanning fingerprints in your house and tasing people.
No. There's a nice moment of comedy here between Q and Bond as Q demonstrates how to drive it, and he's very unsettledly trying to like drag his finger and the car's jerking back and forth. And then James Bond says, "Oh, let me give it a shot." And so he, you know, fluidly draws his finger across the thing. The car is doing donuts. James Bond theme music is blasting, you know, full jazzy brass going.
He has a smooth touch.
Yes. Jazzy Brass is my drag name. But so anyway, they go through the they go through the whole thing of introducing the car. He gets in the car, drives to the party, drops it off at the valet. So this has a bossy German lady voice thing, apparently. And he says in German to the valet, "Don't let her boss you around."
He also said when he got the car, "I think we've met."
Yes.
Because James Bond has slept with everyone he's ever met.
Including cars.
Do you think he got intimate with the vehicle?
I don't know. It depends on how well equipped it was.
But he's got a drinking problem. And some free time.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting watching this today was I wonder if a James Bond movie could do a similar car thing these days with like a Tesla and just have it in the driver mode.
Totally. I mean, even some of the newer BMWs have some like slightly automated driving type things.
Yeah. But I was just thinking like in terms of modernization, Tesla would probably be the route they would go.
Yeah, totally. But James Bond could bang a Tesla.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he'd still be using a Sony Xperia phone, but...
Is he still under contract with Sony?
Yes, I believe so. Sony has distribution rights. I don't remember how it all works. There's MGM, United Artists, and then somehow Sony comes into the arrangement later. But
they get to come in and ruin everything with their notes.
With their Sony Electronics devices. But... he drops the car, goes to the horrible party. This is just like a ridiculously, comically bad party. Elliot Carver is telling the worst stories about stuff. Bond introduces himself as a banker named James Bond, which is stealthy, but easy to remember in case somebody calls out your name. And then he goes upstairs to talk to Paris, who is not excited to see him. Terry Hatcher gives him a pretty good slap. I will compliment Terry Hatcher's slap. That was a good one. And they you know, exchange dialogue, and a waiter comes by and asks if they would like a drink, and he says he'd like a martini. She says she orders for him a martini, shaken not stirred. And then he orders for her and says it's. Shot of tequila. Neat. And it's just like, no, gross. Who would do that? But apparently that was her former life, and she says no.
Yeah, I'll apparently they met in Cabo San Lucas.
Yeah. They met at Senior Frogs. she says, Mrs. Carver will have a glass of Mr. Carver's champagne.
So of course, as every rich guy does, he has to own his own vineyard.
Mm-hmm. Well, or at least just buy in bulk the champagne and then put your name on it. But I'm sure he does actually own a vineyard in the movie's timeline. They have conversation, which is recorded by Gupta. We cut away to that moment. And it's about how, you know, they, you know, had seen each other before, blah, 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 blah.
Do you think Mr. Gupta is always recording Terry Hatcher, or is he just like this looks like it'll be an interesting conversation to record and add to my locker of porn.
That would have been an interesting conversation with Gupta and Carver, where he's just like, why were you recording
my wife? What do you mean? I do this from time to time. Isn't that in my contract? No, it's not in your contract. Oh.
Well, it's so unusual because I have all these other hours of footage and she doesn't say anything like this.
Yeah, we should discuss our data retention policy probably.
It is weird. It also completely unnecessary, I feel like. Because of the way that they behave and because of James Bond's suspicious nature, it's enough without necessarily having the footage, but I suppose it ties into the media theme of it all. There's the presentation where they're going to do the thing of unveiling the stuff, blah, blah, blah. James Bond is called away by the goons, the security goons, to the little soundproof room where the people with ADR tell him that it's a soundproof room, Mr. Bond. Nobody can hear you scream. And then they proceed to beat on him a little.
The old men that fake kick him.
Yes. I don't know why they had to be old. It's like, oh no, I'm being beaten up by mall cops, German mall cops. but they beat him up for a little while Elliot's giving a speech, which is fine because one of the security guards is distracted, the one who's actually in like the control room booth. And then James Bond is beating the crap out of everybody else in the background with it silent, of course, because they're in a soundproof room. And it's kind of funny because he like hits somebody with like a bass and like throws somebody in a piano and whatever. But then he crashes a guy through the glass. They get all beat up. He smacks some guy over the head with an ashtray, some sort of crystal ashtray that somebody was keeping around in their recording booth. And then James Bond cuts the power for a station break.
Not only do they have a like a jazz studio in Mr. Carver's, I don't know, keynote presentation room, apparently the control room for the recording studio is also where you throw the switch to turn off the satellites.
It's very conveniently located, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, you know, eight little switches and you can turn off the whole building, including the satellites.
Yeah, it's not even locked. But the weird thing is that when the power goes out, these floodlights come on, and in the room when Stamper finally gets in there and is looking over all of the old men who are trying to get up off the floor because they've been pummeled, there are floodlights in the room, but they weren't architecturally part of the room. They're on C-stands that are covered in black fabric, and you can see where the black fabric wasn't put all the way to the ground, and you can see the metal part of the C-stand sticking out underneath. And I hate it. I hate it so much. It just really irritates me to no end. So sloppy.
Well, you know, you gotta hold your lights up with something.
I really want to know what the story was. Like, oh no, we can't permanently mount these floodlights in here, but we really need them for this shot. Okay, put them on these C-stands. Ah, but then everybody's going to wonder why there's C-stands there. Cover them in black fabric. No one will know.
Well, there are these little clips that you can clip to the metal part of like a drop ceiling and attach lights to, which is what we normally do for that kind of stuff. But maybe the floodlights were too heavy for that or something. I don't know.
It looks silly. But nobody notices the kind of stuff. But Bond goes back to his hotel room where he's apparently been shooting the half a bottle's worth of Smirnoff, which is just seems so unpleasant to me.
By himself, mostly in the dark with a gun.
Playing with his gun. just seems, none of this seems healthy.
Seems real well adjusted.
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those, they should do a movie where it's just like James Bond medical appointments. And it's just like, so why did you feel like you needed to play with your gun when you were doing that? How's your liver test results?
He'd make like a sarcastic joke and the doctor would be like, no, really, we need to talk. Like, let's just drop the defense mechanism here. Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a movie where James Bond goes to therapy?
Well, technically that was the beginning of the last movie when he's being evaluated for his fitness by the very British lady when they're on the mountain road.
Right. Well, I mean, as opposed to being evaluated in a speeding car, like, has anyone ever made him sit on a couch and talk about his feelings?
I'm not sure, but feel free to reach out and get in touch with us, people, if you find out. But they get through. Terry Hatcher comes in the thing. They get through their conversation about stuff, and then they have a cheesy blah 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 thing, and nobody cares. Meanwhile, Carver is all like, "Oh no, my wife is cheating on me!" Surprise. And then he is going to make an appointment with a doctor. Meanwhile, James Bond is told by Terry Hatcher that there is a secret room, a secret lab on the top floor of the building that even she's not supposed to know about. Which
and
is,
and there's a secret door on the roof to get in.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like, how did you find out about this?
Why do you know this? Why would you have retained this information? And also, why are you sharing it with James Bond?
Like, I believe her when she says she's not supposed to know it. I just don't understand the part where she knows it. like, was she, like, in the commissary, and she overheard two security guards saying, oh, man, we really got to work on that security door that's on the roof to the secret lab? Like,
yeah, exactly. Elevator's out this week. What's the big deal? What's going on up there? Oh, they're turning the whole top floor into a secret lab. Really annoying.
It's very strange. I mean, maybe Elliot was up there one time, and he told her to come on over because he needed a sandwich or something and wanted to say hi. I have no idea.
He went up there so he could, like, tent his fingers and say, very good, and then just look around, and then they left.
Yeah, well, James Bond breaks in, and he overhears a conversation. No one notices that the door is open on the roof, but he overhears a conversation with Gupta and lackeys where he's explaining that they will need to take the satellite over to the launch pad. I don't know how many launch pads there are near Hamburg, but they have a horrible plastic model of the satellite we saw earlier in CG, just sort of leaning on its side, like balanced on the end by the staircase. They all leave. Bond goes down, uses the fingerprint thing, breaks into the stuff, gets the encoder out of there from the safe with the dirty stuff, and then he's making his way out when he hears somebody breaking in, and it is Wei Lin. They share a little moment, and she runs back the way she came.
Way to go, Wei Lin. Yeah,
all the security guards are alerted, so he locks the door, runs back up to the thing, knocks over the satellite. It falls over. Again, not a clean room.
Satellite right there, man.
Not a clean room, not where you'd store a satellite, not how you would package a satellite for launch, none of this stuff. But anyway, he goes up the stairs, blows the lock thing, then goes back down through the other thing into the atrium, and then he's being shot at. But don't worry, no one in this movie can hit anything. Even with their automatic rifles, Wei Lin is going down the side of a thing, slowly walking on like her little rappelling tension thing, which is hilarious because there are machine guns shooting, just spraying bullets everywhere. She's not being hit.
Yeah, they don't have deflections of bullets in this movie.
No. So they have Bond get down to the printing room, and there's fighting and stuff, and then he throws a guy into a printing press and has a quip, and then he goes over to the thing where they have the rolls of paper, and there's another thing, blah, 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 blah. He gets back to the hotel where he finds Terry Hatcher dead. And there is a news broadcast playing on the TV about the death of Mrs. Carver. And then, as he's snuggling with her corpse, the news broadcaster says, and an unidentified male with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And his eyes perk up at that. And he turns around, and there's Dr. Kaufman, who is a comic figure and is completely miscast, etc. He says a bunch of nonsense about how he's going to shoot him. Pierce Brosnan.
And he holds his gun in a very, very silly way, very close to his face, so you know that means he's a very good shot.
Yes. And Pierce Brosnan, for his part, is trying to play this serious and is trying to act shaken up about Paris's death, etc. But then you cut back to Kaufman, who is just being silly. Meanwhile, the henchmen are trying to break into James Bond's car, which is in the parking garage, but they are
with sledgehammers made out of foam.
I think they're rubber, but they're unsuccessful. So they call up Dr. Kaufman to have him do it, and James Bond says, "Oh, well, this is how you do it. You just push recall 3 send." Dr. Kaufman pushes exactly one button, and then the security
gets electrocuted. Yeah,
he gets electrocuted. James Bond maneuvers the pistol he's holding back around to the side of his head.
Has a little bit of difficulty overpowering Mr. Kaufman, which is surprising.
Yes, considering Mr. Kaufman was just stunned.
Also, he's, you know, he's probably not the physical equal of James Bond.
No, but they wanted to have the dialogue here between the two of them, so he couldn't have overpowered him instantly and shot him.
Oh, the crucial dialogue of Mr. Kaufman saying, "I'm just a professional doing a job," and him saying, "Me too." That's definitely something we needed to hear, because we've never heard that before in any movie ever.
Nope. It's totally unique. So he shoots him, and then he skedaddles over the rooftop. And for some reason, Stamper went up to the rooftop to look at the hotel. I don't know. And he sees James Bond getting out of there. But James Bond gets back to the parking garage. And there are all the lackeys around the car. So he uses the remote to start up the car. And then he jumps in a rolled down window. Again, there's like four buttons and a trackpad on this. So how it does any of this?
You know, there might have been like eight buttons, because I think like around the buttons there are like circular. There's like an edge button too. But yeah, there it's you've got non-labeled buttons that do just everything.
Yes. Don't think too hard about it. But he gets in there, and then there's an extended car chase. And I feel like for me, this is the part where the movie gets good.
This is probably the start of the movie.
Yeah, because this is where you start to get the action set pieces one after the other, whereas the beginning part of this movie was a lot of talking, and it wasn't good talking. So I feel like this is the part where it starts to pay off, because now we don't need to talk anymore. We can just blow up stuff. And they go up and down and all around this parking garage. There's caltrops, there's missiles, there's...
reinflating tires after he runs over his own caltrops accidentally.
Yes, and he laughs when he does it. He's so enamored by the fact that the tires reinflated.
Also, that's not how run flat tires work.
No. Well, I mean, it's a little late to critique how this car functions at this point. But there's also the thing where he goes to cut the steel wire,
and it extends like 12 inches up out of the engine compartment to cut the wire, like right where the radiator would be.
Yeah, it is so funny to me how you would have this wire cutter precisely calibrated for this height. Like, did you know for sure that that's where the steel wire would go? Because like, there's no flexibility in this. It doesn't go up or down any further. So it just seems silly. But he cuts through the steel thing. It whips back around. Then he gets up to the rooftop and he guns it. I think this is... I always thought this was just hilarious. It's just like he has destroyed a whole bunch of cement that's falling down on a very populated street. And a car that... flies through the air down into the front of the Avis building. So theoretically, maybe 6 to 12 people have been injured in this process. We're not exactly sure. But it just seemed unnecessary. But it is nice that he returned the car.
Yeah, so that's why they did that. That's the joke.
Yeah. Then goes off to meet up with a CIA guy, and they're at a base operating whatever it was, South China somewhere.
Yeah, he's wearing his formal dress blues, his military outfit that he probably doesn't wear at any other point in any of the other movies, because it would just be silly, but I guess you got to wear that when you're on the base. And then he hands the encoder to some guy, and he's like, "Oh my goodness, the missing encoder." And he's like, "Could this be used to, like, you know, set... boat off course maybe?" And the guy's like, "You mean the Devonshire?" He's like, whoa, nobody said the Devonshire. We're not accusing anybody anything, because the Americans are technically not involved in this, so let's not say words and stuff. And yes. Then he's like, "Yeah, that could happen." And then he plugs it in. He's like, "Look at this, there's an offset here, so there's where the Devonshire said it went down, but it could probably be over here theoretically, if indeed all of the stuff that we were talking about that we're not actually talking about is true and real and stuff." And then he goes there.
Yeah. optically lining up two circles doesn't really seem like a good diagnostic tool, but
because they don't have edges. But also, just like this whole scene is a very complicated way of saying, like, all right, we need to figure out where that ship is, because if we figure out, all right, I stole the encoder from Carver. If I can prove that he used this to set the ship off course and cause this incident, then we can get him. We'll get him that way. And then they run the diagnostic on the encoder and they're like, aha, there's a discrepancy here. But is this the same discrepancy that caused the accident? We need to prove it, probably, I guess. So he does a halo jump into the ocean, which is very fun, because there's a lot of try not to break your neck, try not to hit your head on the thing, try not to get tangled in your shoot and drown, even though you have air tanks that you could breathe with. So he does that, and it's all fun. It's very cool. And then he goes and finds the ship. And then rather than going like, cool, found the ship, got the encoder, proved they did that wrong, he goes in to inspect it, and there's a giant hole, which is, by the way, twice as large as the front end of the drill, but that's neither here nor there. They needed the hole to be big enough for him to swim through. So he swims in, he's cruising around. You get a couple of score cues that, like, you know, hit you with some loud music when you see a dead body float by, even though the dead bodies just kind of look like a guy holding his breath with his eyes open, and they don't look very decomposed. Mm-mm. And then he finds the missile room, and he's like, oh, look at that. One of the big ballistic missiles is gone. And then he turns around and what's her name's there?
Weyland's there. One thing, though, to go back to the halo jump, I like shouty guy who's on there, and it's all ADR. And he's like, the high altitude, low opening jump, the halo jump is where we get the most fatalities. And the way he says fatalities is just like, just cracks me up. But back to this.
What do you think about the ADR lines in this movie, too? Particularly with Carver, there are a couple instances where they added lines where he didn't say anything at all. Mm-hmm. When he walks over to Stamper and goes like, I have a problem with a banker, can I speak to you for a moment? He doesn't say anything for the first line. He doesn't say, I have a problem with a banker. He just walks over to Stamper and says, can I see you for a moment? And they 80-yard a line in there because his face is kind of looking towards the ground and they hope we didn't notice.
Yes.
That happens at several points in this movie. It drives me nuts.
Yes. And there's also a lot of ADR where they're replacing dialogue that I presume was too noisy or garbled.
Yeah.
So Weyland, they rendezvous with each other, and then to add tension, I guess, the rock starts crumbling underneath the Devonshire, and
the ship crashed onto like a precipice under the sea there, and just their presence is apparently enough to disturb the rock and make it tilt and slide and fall over and stuff. Not that they're really, like, no, they're not causing a ruckus in there or anything, but, you know, swimming around and, like, touching doors apparently is enough to imbalance it and break the rock. He gets scared when he turns around and finds Weyland there, because why wouldn't you? Because how the hell did she get there? It's not explained, doesn't really matter, apparently. And then it shifts, and then all of the big Costco racks full of missiles fall over and slam the door shut, which is very poor design on the British folks side, because why would you didn't they do it in GoldenEye, where they push over all the bookshelves to close the door, right? They use the same thing here.
Yeah, all the missiles fell over and closed the door.
Yeah, and then they're trying to escape, oh no, because the ship's gonna fall over and sink deeper, and there's one escape hatch, but it's too big to go through if you have your air tanks on the back. So rather than taking the air tank out of their pack and, like, pushing it down the tube in front of them, they decide to just take deep breaths and swim for it through the tube, which, you know, lucky for them, works out.
Yeah. It wasn't, like, locked or anything on the other side, but he goes, they both go up to the surface, and she has a line about banking, and he says, you know, it's the opportunities for travel. But then the fishing boat that she apparently had arranged travel on has been boarded by Stamper and his goons, and they are flown off on a helicopter that landed somewhere, and they are enclosed that came from who knows where. And they arrive at the Saigon office of Elliot Carver, which has an enormous banner on the front of it with a photo of Elliot Carver. And
he likes to look at his own face. He even has it hanging in his own office there.
Yes, it's a little strange. But he, especially, unfortunately, if you, sorry, Jonathan Pierce, but if you have his face, maybe you don't need to do that. But they land the helicopter.
He reminds me of one of my high school teachers.
He doesn't remind me of anyone. He just kind of looks like himself. But he's always kind of looked exactly the same. He just has his hair whiteness has changed over the years. But they walk past General Chang, and Michelle Yeoh has the unfortunate job of getting to say General Chang, and then looking back and then forwards and saying that to James Bond, so that we know that when they go into the room later on, that that's meaningful for the conversation they have with Elliot Carver, where he says, "No doubt you saw General Chang in the hallway on your way in." But blah,
also,
blah, blah.
When Ricky Jay walks up behind Carver and he goes, like, "General Chang is on the line for you" or something, I swear he says something else and they replaced it with Chang. Like, they had a different name for General Chang during this part of this movie, or he just said the wrong word.
Maybe. It was for the helicopter, and he keeps bugging him to go on the helicopter. Carver's like, "Yeah, so Stamper is a student of late Dr. Kaufman. Here's his glass case full of torture devices, chakra torture devices," which is not the correct enunciation for that. But yeah. Then he just starts playing with things. There's like a thing with a hooky thing. And then what I like about this also is Elliot Carver says, "Save this one for last. Mr. Bond's heart should beat just long enough for him to see it beat for one last time," or whatever. And it's like, well, why wouldn't you take the heart out the last? Like, that's the whole point. Like, if you take the heart out first, then he's dead.
Yeah, it kind of defeats the whole point of the torture, because
yeah,
he's dead.
Yeah, thanks for the special instruction there, Elliot.
Unless they're going to put him on like a bypass machine so he can keep circulation, but like have his heart out.
Silly. But they get out of there by doing some maneuvers, and they're handcuffed together, so they get to, you know, swing each other and kick and do things. They get out onto the roof.
They get to jump and jive.
They use a cleaver to break the ropes, but not their handcuffs. And then they go down the middle of Elliot Carver's face, tearing a big strip. And then they break into an office window building, which was different from all of the other office window buildings, because that was
very
the one that was open.
Conveniently placed window. They couldn't just like say open the window. They had to kick it. So.
Yeah, well, a lot of those office buildings don't have windows that open for insurance reasons.
Yeah, that particular window opened.
Oh, yeah, it did, because it was replaced with something else, because it doesn't look like the other ones. And so they bust on in there. They stand back up, and all the office workers are like, oh my. And then they go down to the street, hop on a bike, and then there's a bike chase that goes on for forever. They're doing the thing of barrels and fruit cart vendors and all that good stuff.
I love when she says go for the barrels or something, because she's got the hook and she's gonna knock the latches out of the truck so the barrels fall down, but she's facing backwards, so she has no idea what's coming up.
Yeah, well, maybe she turned her head.
She didn't. She just shouts go for the barrels.
But
I mean, maybe when you're just driving around Saigon, you know that there's bound to be a truck full of barrels somewhere, and you're just like, "Yeah, that's just general best practices. Go for the barrels, and then when you do, I'll hit the thing."
Yeah, but then they have the helicopter come after them. This is not the helicopter that Elliot Carver was going to meet the general in. This is a different helicopter.
This is a helicopter that is just like it's in places it doesn't need to be at times. It's like, it's low when it needs to be jumped over. It can tilt forward and put the blade 6 inches from the ground to, like, attack crowds and stuff when it needs to, and it holds very still, and it's definitely not fake when it crashes into stuff.
Well, I mean, I think this is pretty effective considering the effects that they could pull off for the time and the stunt performances that they could do.
I distinctly remember probably one of those stupid DVD on TVs or whatever, when they do the jump over the helicopter, I remember seeing the, you know, the behind the scenes shot where they actually did that jump, but like, you know, the roof of that other house is just like covered in cardboard boxes that they crash into instead of like going through the roof into another apartment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks good. And they pull it off, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They finally best the helicopter by wrapping up the whatever that rear rotor one is, the vertical one that controls it from spinning all around.
Stabilizer or something, I don't know.
Yes, and so they blow up that helicopter. More specifically, the front nose of it hits a building and then explodes, which is not where you keep the gas tank in a helicopter, but that is what happens in a James Bond movie.
Elliot Carver keeps the gas tank in his helicopters.
Yes. The superior gas tank location. So
it's, you know, the British thing, you know, the steering wheel's on the other side, the gas tank's in the front.
Yeah, gas tank in the front, party in the back. So they shower up, and then she...
Why did they shower?
Because they're covered in helicopter fumes. I don't know. It was just some sultry street showering. And then she...
it's the kind of shower you see, like, on the edge of a public beach or whatever, and it's just in the middle of Saigon, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember seeing any just like eyewash stations or like emergency showers in Vietnam, but whatever. Maybe I was in the wrong town.
I mean, I wouldn't be able to speak to it. But what's weird is that she uses her earring now to undo the handcuff as opposed to
earlier.
Any other point earlier.
Yes. And there was an issue with the fact that they were having difficulty riding a motorcycle.
Yes, that could have been useful. But presumably they were under so much stress and pressure that they didn't want to stop to do this. But she handcuffs him to the thing, then goes to her secret little safe house in Saigon that she has, except it's not so secret and not so safe because there are guys who either followed her there or knew where it was because of General Chang. And the guys all go in, and James Bond sees all the guys, and then he goes and he takes out the lookouts, and he takes out two lookouts in the amount of time it took her to get like six guys, and it's all very Hong Kong action movie, fighting stuff inside, there's people running up things and over things, and ladders being pulled, and et cetera. But she beats up everybody, and then there's one guy left standing, and then James Bond comes in and takes him out. And then she's like, I could have, you know, handled him. And then she like kicks the guy over the side railing, and then they go down to where she flips over all the stuff and the red computer stuff comes out and all the weapons and things. They explain how she was suspicious. Their government was suspicious because stealth material had gone missing from one of General Chang's bases.
Stealth material had gone missing.
Yes.
Sure, well, just a bunch of retroreflective panels went missing, so that means he's got to be making a ship out of it or something.
Well, she says that they thought that you were making a plane, but then James Bond says, but what about a boat? Because that would let you get close enough to the Devonshire to get the thing.
What about a Jeep?
I don't think the Jeep would have gotten close enough to the Devonshire to get the cruise missile. I mean, the canoe maybe, but where would you put the missile?
You know those canoes that have like the separate like outrigger out to the side so they don't fall over? You could balance it on that.
I'm not sure that's advisable, but well,
you know, make it out of carbon fiber. It'd be nice and light and buoyant.
But then what about this? Anyway, so that doesn't matter. They have a nice little chit chat, and there's explosions and the flaming firehead dragon thing and the fan.
Yeah, there's lots of comedy. There's, you know, there's the dragon head that shoots fire. There's the, you know, the fan that shoots the things out, and he has the line.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Chinese technology.
Yeah,
yeah. So it's entertaining, and light, and let's the two of them get
is
along.
Is it though? And then he's like, "Oh, look, that guy woke up over there. He's coming right for you." And she slaps the desk, and it flings a large box at the guy and knocks him out.
Yes, so I was stupid. Entertained.
I was not entertained. It was stupid.
Well, you're wrong. But then, we can respectfully disagree.
Like literally every James Bond movie, he goes like, "Oh, look, a watch, just like my watch." And she goes, "We've made some improvements," because every single movie has to go, "We've made some improvements."
Mm-hmm. Well, also. James Bond's watch. I forget what it was originally, but it wasn't an Omega until the last movie.
Mm.
But they get out of there to the fishing village where they're going to start their search, and she says that she's narrowed it down to Kowloon Bay, and she has like a list of different villages that they can search the area. And then they have the dialogue that they searched all the stuff except for this last one. Meanwhile, the Bedford, HMS Bedford, and all the stuff, the saber rattling and things, and the control center, everybody's nervous and blah, 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 blah. M bursts into the room, and she's got the printout from 007, and she says, you know, have your men look for a stealth boat. It could be very small on radar. They relay that to the Bedford, etc.
It's trash.
And Bond and Weyland use their Zodiac to get up underneath the stealth boat. They start attaching mines that are going to set off in 10 minutes once they're clear.
She's got to go to the other side, and rather than taking the boat and just like driving, you know, 10 feet over to the left, she decides to do like the monkey bars across the top.
Yeah, well, it just shows how physically superior she is to James Bond, because he couldn't do that. He wasn't going to do those monkey bars. They start attaching all the mines, except Weyland doesn't notice that there is a security camera that sees her, and Carver notices it, because one of his security guards is, I don't know, doing Sudoku or crossword puzzle or something.
He's checking his Instagram feed or something.
Well, it was like a clipboard, and he's like, what do I pay you people for? He has Stamper go get her and says, you know, if he's...
terrible ratings on Glassdoor, doesn't he?
I'm sure he's not ideal to work for, but, you know, with these large conglomerates that control most of the job market, there's very little alternative for most people.
Yeah.
But
they should all grit. They should quit their jobs.
Sure.
Go freelance, start a union.
Mm-hmm. a freelance henchman union? How would that work?
I feel like this is like a Venture Brothers thing.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, they have the henchman support group. So you sent me a link that has all of the watches that James Bond uses.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Yeah, that's nice.
A lot of watches here.
I like looking at watches. I don't need to own them. Oh, the other day I forgot my Apple Watch.
How could you?
And I walked the whole. I lost my stand streak. That's not good.
Oh, but, for shame.
But the weird thing was the whole day, I just kept like looking at my wrist. And
it you feel like an idiot.
I was slowly driving myself crazy, just being like, there's something missing for me. I have like phantom watch syndrome. But anyway, back to this. Stamper gets her by just putting his arms around her and bear hugging her inside of the ship.
She beats up so many people, but Stamper's so big and strong and German that he just like sneaks out and grabs her and just like walks back in.
Yeah, it's not really super convincing. But then meanwhile, James Bond has to deal with the like, I don't know, C squad, the like real dum-dums who are like just waiting for the door to completely open up before they even start to look around.
And there's some weird choices here in the camera work too, because they avoid a lot of the violence. Like, I don't know if there was a conscious choice made in this movie to say, let's keep it very PG-13, but like he's hiding and waiting for the door to open so he can stab the guy. And you see that he's holding the knife, but at no point do you see like his hand hit the other guy or like anything really serious happen. It's just like he swings his arm out of frame and then the guy is like, ugh, and like crunch, like leans forward a little bit like he gets stabbed.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
It's kind of like you had said earlier, a little like TV-esque in terms of that, where it seems a little reserved. But was this PG-13 or PG?
It is PG-13. I had to check while I was blabbing.
And so he uses one of the bodies of the incapacitated security guy as a decoy. When Stamper shoots, he just drops the body casually into the water, and Stamper's like, okay, well, James Bond is dead. No need to investigate.
Got him.
Yeah, there was this enormous door closing sound that came from over there that couldn't have been anything.
God, this is the point in the movie where I feel like they ran out of money for post-production, because the sound mixing and the sound effects they choose to use are so ridiculously bad and cliche. Like, you know, shortly hereafter, where he's fighting Stamper, like, up on top of the missile, he punches him 5 times in a row, and they use the same punch sound effect, slightly pitch shifted down every single time, where it's just like, pew, 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 and it's just like, what? You don't have any more sound effects in there? Like, all the gunshots are terrible. All of the, like, ugh, like the people dying. And then, of course, as I have to point out, Michelle Yeoh shoots the computer controlling the ship and brings it to a halt. And as she shoots it, they use the breaking pottery sound effects twice. Oh,
boy. I mean, ceramic is very sophisticated in terms of the material that you would build with.
You can make an Apple Watch out of ceramic. You can make a guidance computer out of ceramic.
You can make a stealth boat engine out of ceramic. But they,
did you hear it this time, though? You know what I'm talking about? That sound effect?
I didn't notice it, but I believe you.
Oh, come on. It's that sound that they use when anyone in any movie gets hit over the head with a pot or like a plant.
Oh, well, I know that from like The Rocketeer and stuff, but I'm not as sensitive to sound effects as you are.
They're so stupid sounding.
It's interesting though how like we both pick up on different things in terms of the sound of a movie. Like, I'm paying attention to the score and you're paying attention to the sound effects. So you miss all of the score cues and I miss all of the sound effect reusing stuff.
When right after that part where Michelle Yeoh is hiding around the corner and they do some really weird like John Woo slow motion for no reason whatsoever, and there's like two guys coming down the aisle pointing guns at her, there's a quick cut where they cut to the guys with guns and they add the sound effect of some gunfire even though none of the guys fire their gun, and you can see both of the barrels of the guys, and you're just like, oh god, whoever was doing the sound design of this, they should not get to do this again.
Yeah, well, something tells me in a situation like that they were told to make it look like she was being shot at.
Probably. And it really sounds like they just ran out of time and budget on this thing.
Yeah. This budget for this was $110 million, but apparently it was rushed. And so they kept pouring money into it to try to get it out there because this was supposed to coincide with Kirk Corcoran's public offering of MGM.
Okay.
Remember Kirk Corcoran?
No. Is that a name I should recognize?
He owned MGM.
Hmm. It sounds like Corky Romano.
No.
Got two sound effect editors on here. One of them worked on Blade Runner, and another one worked on The World Is Not Enough.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. A logical progression.
And also Das Boot. Oh, my God.
I mean, I can't say I've noticed anything about the sound at Das Boot, but...
Does Das Boot have sound?
It's not a silent movie.
Which one am I thinking of? Potemkin? Potemkin. I'm thinking of Potemkin.
Same thing. But they...
totally the same thing.
She gets trapped and brought up to Elliot Carver, who's monologuing about his evil plan. Bond overhears all of this while he's going through Stamper's collection of mason jars and puts a grenade in one of them with a remote detonator charge that's triggered by his watch. I mean, I just like the idea that there's just like a bunch of mason jars just floating around the ship. It's just like, yes, for when you're pickling stuff on your stealth boat. Like, what are you using with
in
those jars
free time,
for?
He likes to make artisanal parfaits for the crew.
Sweetie, this is his overnight oats in.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, he's a big chia seed guy like you.
He's in like the hot new trend of you put the salad dressing in the bottom and then you like layer the salad ingredients inside the jar and then you put the lid on top.
That's a thing?
That's a thing.
Then what do? You shake it like the McDonald's
salad?
Yeah,
you shake them? You shake it.
The McShaker or whatever those were called?
I don't know.
They don't still sell those, right?
Maybe. I would not know the current menu offerings at a McDonald's.
You don't remember those commercials, though, where it was like a salad in a big gulp cup and you were supposed to shake it?
Maybe? I don't know. It's not ringing a bell. I remember like the dumb snack wrap thing where it was like, here's some lettuce on a tortilla with a
piece of grilled chicken. Oh, when they turned the Big Mac into a wrap?
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. I blocked that one out completely. I was talking about the chicken one, but yeah, I now that you mentioned the Big Mac one, I remember that. Those wraps. So not as good as the California Chicken Cafe combo wrap.
Well, FYI. We don't all have California Chicken Cafes now, do we?
It's just my California bias, but
it's all right. I've never gotten a wrap at McDonald's.
I don't think I. Well, let me think. When I was a kid.
I bet you have.
When I was a kid, I had their breakfast burrito that they had. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, were they the ones that had the tiny breakfast burritos that you would get two of?
Yes. But yeah. They were more like, I don't know, like a taquito. Like, it was, yeah. It was weird. It was
that, like, weird, like, small round sausage that somehow was just, like, you could intersperse it in between the eggs.
But also, it was, it had, like, a disgusting salsa, and
it was very bad, yeah. It was picante on the packet is what it said.
It was, like, 60% flour tortilla when it was all rolled up.
Yeah. I didn't get these, but a lot of the production road trips that I took with one of my coworkers, he always used to get those, and I would just get, you know, an Egg McMuffin or something.
Like a breakfast sandwich is definitely the way to go. But yeah. If you have to at a McDonald's, I'm not some person who lives in Chicago and feels the need to defend McDonald's as an institution. But the thing about
you know, they got a test kitchen.
Yeah,
test out new recipes.
I've heard this. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing that you would get in trouble for testing on animals, but go ahead, just try it for yourself, I suppose. But they got the jars. He's got the grenade. He sets it off after he has this conversation with Elliot to distract everybody, because the grenade punches a hole in the hull of the ship, so they're visible on radar. And this means that the British ship can see them, and they communicate this to the Chinese, and they say, yeah, we're not going to do anything unless it turns towards Chinese waters. Yeah.
And they just start shooting at him. They're just like, blow him up. It's fine. And, you know, Stamper and Carver, they're like, he's exposed us. And he's like, yes, and also himself. And it's like, well, he doesn't care.
No, that was all part of the plan.
He's trying to
Elliot.
Take you down. Do you realize that it's not like, this is not a zero-sum game. It's not like, he wins, you lose, you win, he lose. All he has to do is, like, set a bunch of your stuff on fire and screw up your plan just enough that either you can't shoot your missile at China or you get caught shooting your missile at China. Like, that's all that has to happen is the fact that, like, you can't drive away after you fire your missile, so the British are going to roll up and be like, we saw what you did. You're going to go to jail now. He's like, aha, but they're going to blow up and sink all of the evidence. It's like, well, we could just dive and go look at it and be like, probably all of the machines probably say, like, Carver on them because he's, you know, a megalomaniac. And he's just got his stuff everywhere.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a poster with his face on it in the break room.
they'd probably swim down there. He'd be like, they destroyed all of the evidence. And the scuba divers would go down there and be like, well, there's like a 30-foot poster of Elliot Carver's face inside this control room here. So I think we know who did this.
Well, one of the things that I think is weird about the scale of this boat, I'm not entirely clear on it. When they're underneath it, it doesn't seem enormous. It seems like it's basically the area that they're walking around underneath. It seems like basically the bay that they're in for most of the rest of the action. So I don't really understand where the engine room is, or like where your barracks would be or anything, like,
or where they keep that giant missile in the big open area.
Well, I mean, it's obvious that it's in the big open area.
Right. But it's like, which side is that on? Cause it's kind of like an upside down U.
Oh, it's on the top.
It's above it? It's above where they drove their little boat in?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's that tall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was in one of the legs.
No. It's not that big. That'd be huge. If it was inside, if that room was inside one of the legs.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't match.
No, she would never have gotten across the monkey bars because the scale of the monkey bars would be ridiculous. It'd be,
yeah, exactly.
Monkey balls.
See, but if you look very carefully, you'll see a lot of doors that apparently go to nowhere. And Kubrick did this very specifically to create a sort of cognitive dissonance in the viewer.
People are stupid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the scale doesn't exactly match up with the one or anything, but I'm just curious.
No, it's just like the outside is like, here's the ship we have, and on the inside, they're like, we're at Pinewood now. I'm like, okay, fine.
But it's just like, where, this is an enormous engine room. Where is that? Like, is it supposed to be in one of the legs? And if so, like, what is in the other leg? Because they look kind of skinny. And I don't know where you put the crew complement when they're not on duty, but there's so many, like, henchmen schmucks that they're shooting through. But she goes to the engine room, she busts up the engine, so they can no longer escape the British destroyer that's coming after them. So we get some very startled reaction shots from Elliot as he seems concerned that they can't move. And he tells Stamper to begin looking in the engine room because he's pretty sure Bond is dead now, because again, nobody, but so there's some rubble. And Bond gets up and shoots up some more people. And Elliot Carver somehow gets behind him and gets the drop on him. But
because he's the bad guy and they have to give him like a reason to do some final monologuing and like feel like he's bested Bond, but like in reality, like, and again, this is one of the scenes where James Bond like actually looks like James Bond, where he's like jumping around, he's beating people up, and he's very, you know, casually, confidently walking towards the control room with the machine gun and blasting everybody, and he's doing his thing, and then suddenly Elliot Carver pops out from nowhere. He pops out from just like camera right and hits him over the head with a pistol and like gives him a concussion.
Yeah, there's no place that he could have been hiding. We've seen this bridge.
It's railing.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very open concept ship. Like, there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah, like, this is... Like, there were big glass doors that aren't there anymore, and it's not like he was hiding behind glass. But there's, I guess, other stations or something, but he wasn't cowering underneath any of them. So it doesn't make any sense how he snuck up behind him. But he makes the, again, horrible mistake of just monologuing and not just killing Bond, which gives Bond enough time to start up the sea drill, startle Carter when he turns around to see the sea drill, and then he...
Which is pointed directly at the control room for some reason. Which, all you have to do is turn it on, or it just comes right at you.
Which also has a track that apparently stretches into the control room, because it's not operating on any other means of locomotion. It's on a track. So there would have been a track that went through the area where there were glass doors into the control room where this desk was.
And this is where it starts to get into, well, not starts to, this is just one of many James Bond things that is like, it's here because it's a James Bond movie and it's a plot point, not because it would make any sense in any context on any planet ever again.
Yeah, this is a silly way to kill Carver, but I kind of almost wonder if killing this guy by a sea drill was like a reverse thing where they're just like, so we want to kill him with a sea drill. And they're like, oh, now we got to write a sea drill into the rest of the movie. But
start with sea drill and you work backwards. Is that,
yeah. Yeah. So they kill him with his swivel headed men's razor. And he is remarkably not that bloody. Then
zero blood. It just immediately crashes into computers.
Yeah, and then Bond goes to disable the rocket, but he is trying to take off like the screws to get the thing. But Stamper shows up, and he's got Weylin wrapped in chains.
And Bond is trying to be all lazy and be like, "Dude, it's over. We're done. I killed your boss. Like, chill out. We're here. We're done." And he's like, "It's personal. You killed my father figure / comedic icon or whatever.
Prepare to die." But he threatens to throw Weylin, and Weylin says, "Use the detonators. They'll set off the when the rocket ignites and blow the thing up." And so he does that, and they just look like the tiniest little things. So I'm sure there's an explosive component to that, but it's just, they seem so small.
Mm-hmm. And they come in a nice little package of 5, like AA batteries, and he just like sticks them on the side.
Mm-hmm. And Stamper dumps her into the water, and so she's on a tank somewhere, in a tank somewhere with some tiny air bubbles.
And you have expect at this point Bond to go like, "Go ahead, kill her. She means nothing to me," because again, that's another thing that happens in all of the Bond movies.
Yeah, which he's already done in this movie. But
and Goldeneye.
Yes, but also with this one. Then Stamper jumps over and they fight and they're stabbing, and Stamper doesn't seem really deterred by the stabbing. And then Bond uses the release to drop the rocket onto his foot, onto Stamper's foot, and he's trapped. And says nine really loud, which is how you know he's German. And then
if the bleach blonde buzz cut didn't illustrate it properly for you,
it was a look.
Yeah. The nine would do it.
Yeah. So and then Bond jumps off to go save Wei Lin. The rocket starts to launch and presumably blows up his foot along with everything else. The boat is on fire and exploded.
Mm-hmm. But luckily they're both underwater, so they don't get detonated. And then he does one of those things that happens in a lot of movies, which always drives me nuts, is that he breathes air into somebody else's mouth so she can breathe and not die. And then he can get her loose, and then they can swim away so they don't catch on fire.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
Yeah, because people don't breathe in oxygen and then breathe out oxygen.
No.
So he's like, here, have some carbon monoxide.
Have some of my love carbon monoxide, along with whatever sexually transmitted diseases I'm sure are on my lips. But he's... They get up to the surface, and then they're floating around on wreckage, and the Bedford's looking for them, for Commander Bond.
Just by shouting over the intercom, going, "Are you there?
Are you there, secret agents?"
As if they were like knocking on somebody's door because they were showing up for a dinner party and nobody's answering.
No, but they're gonna get down to business on this wreckage, apparently.
Yeah, because they're both secret agents. They both know what happens after the bad guy's dead. It's a little makeout time.
Yes. This was all just foreplay.
You know, but after all of his years of damaging his body with alcohol and, you know, all of his sexual escapades, the only way he can get it up anymore is by killing people and blowing up ships beforehand as foreplay.
Yes. It's an interesting dysfunction. But they... they have the credits come up, and this is when Katie Lang's would-be opening starts playing, and they roll on out of there.
This movie's stupid.
I mean, I like it, but like, I'm not going to hold this up individually by itself as a good film. Also, I want to just point out something. This opened the same day as Titanic. As you might imagine, this was number two at the box office.
What stupid idiot decided to do that?
I don't know. Presumably Kirkorkian, but
Kirkorkian.
No,
I can't. What? Where is that name on IMDb here somewhere?
No, he just ran. He was the billionaire owner of the studio. He was the owner of MGM. He apparently bought it, I think, so that he could get the name for the casinos for Las Vegas.
I've been there.
Yes. Kirk, I stayed at the MGM Signature, the towers that are behind the ugly pyramid thing.
I mean, everybody's got like a separate tower for expanding rather than building a separate hotel.
Yeah. So this is directed by Roger Spottiswoode, who that's his name.
Oh boy, that sounds like a fake porn director name.
He's Canadian British. He was born in Ontario, and he's directed such classics as Turner and Hooch, and not finding anything else. Are these classics?
The Sixth Day with Arnold Schwarzenegger. 48. Oh, he's a writer on 48 Hours.
Wait, the sixth. Oh no, that's oh goodness. That's not what I thought that was going to be. So anyway, yeah. So he's not maybe like amazing.
I mentioned it to you in the Slack, but I forgot to mention now that Gerard Butler has a one-line cameo in this movie when he's very young and very Scottish.
Yes. Yes, he's a crew member aboard the HMS Devonshire.
Mm-hmm. 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 Which means he dies.
Yes.
Spottiswood.
But, some interesting things here. Michelle Yeoh would go on after this to do many things, most famously Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, in terms of Western performances. She's a huge Hong Kong action star since the 80s. There is some amazing footage you can see of her with some American lady who was also studying Kung Fu, where they fight together. It's hilarious. She's you know, had a very long and prestigious career, and she was recently in Crazy Rich Asians, so she was in a lot of award shows recently. But she's been on Star Trek Discovery.
I was just about to say, I'm looking at her IMDb stuff, and there's a Star Trek Discovery.
She is theoretically going to be getting her own spin-off Star Trek show that she's going to be the star of.
She's got a leather cape on, a lot of black here.
Okay, spoiler alert for Star Trek Discovery, since I know you're going to watch it start to finish.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I got to pay for that one, right?
Yeah, that's the one you got to sign up for a special service for. This is a show where she starts as the very Federation-y, Star Trek-y captain role model for
when she's wearing the gold vest?
No. And then she's killed and immediately, basically, in the second episode. It was like a two-parter, so she dies at the end of that.
So when she's in the blue outfit here, Star Trek outfit.
Yes, and then after she's killed, they go through many episodes of things, and then they cross over to an alternate timeline, alternate universe, where she didn't die, and she is the emperor of all civilization, and she's evil.
That's nice. And she was in Guardians of the Galaxy, too.
Yeah, but she didn't have like a big role in that one. She was like one of the gangster mob bosses, like Stallone was, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember that movie. I saw it.
It wasn't good.
No. Stallone was in that movie, huh?
Yep. He was a gangster mob boss. I don't know what was going on with that movie. But then the other Star Trek connection on this is, of course, Nicholas Meyer was apparently doing some of the rewrite for it.
Who?
The director and writer of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, as well as the writer of parts of Star Trek IV and the director of Star Trek VI.
That guy. Sure, yes. Totally.
Yes.
I know him.
Yes.
We're pals.
Anyway, that's how you find it, the Star Trek connection. The Trekkers, the Dreamers, and me.
You always got to be looking for that connection.
Yes, it's all here. But what a decision to open this the same weekend as Titanic. Who would do that?
Stupid people.
Yeah. So it was number two at the box office, as you might imagine.
And number two in my heart. As in poo.
Oh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I should see Crouching Tiger one of these days.
Critics and audiences today have started appreciating Tomorrow Never Dies for its prescience. Den of Geek, on the film's 20th anniversary, observed the film's plot. It's an improbable setup, which was likely intended as a satire of Murdoch's unaccountable media empire, but the risks of such technological manipulation have since proven to be frighteningly plausible. Den of Geek also highlights that technology wasn't the only modern danger to be preempted in Tomorrow Never Dies. It also offers a revealing peek into the confused state of the British national psyche, which might help explain the country's ongoing Brexit debates. Similarly,
This movie is a Brexit think piece, is it?
Yeah, apparently. Similarly, Head Stuff highlights relevance today, noting that some modern critics argue that Carver's emphasis on traditional journalism date the film, and that if the internet existed to such an extent as it does 20 years later, his plan would be instantly foiled. Not really sure that people have been following the current events in the past 2 years. This reflects legendary logic wait, this reflects legendary critic Roger Ebert's thoughts at the time, who felt the villain, slightly more contemporary and plausible than usual, brings some subtler than usual satire to the film, and that the longest running movie series longest running movie series seems fit for. This isn't even a sentence. What is, who wrote this? Wikipedia, you jerks. It's not a sentence.
I did find a handful of typos on the Wikipedia page for this movie already.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. This is, like, certainly not my favorite James Bond movie or anything, but I just definitely enjoy it more than you do.
It's forgettable because it's too stupid to be fun. Well, it's not stupid enough to be fun, and it's too stupid to be serious.
Oh, a consequence of them rushing to get this all done. David Arnold was hired as the composer on the recommendation of John Barry, who had heard David Arnold's album that was released in 97, but he'd been working on it prior to that, of covers of John Barry's James Bond work, where he's got people like Amy Mann and what's his name, the Iggy Pop, and the band Pulp, I guess, and like other stuff where they're all doing covers of famous James Bond songs and stuff. And so John Barry is like, yeah, so you guys, if you're looking for a new composer, you should get this guy. And they did get David Arnold, and he worked out really well, and they kept him, and he goes on to do the other stuff. But the album for this was rushed, so they only had, and because they were recording chronologically, they only had music from the first part of this when they first released the album. So there's no music from the end of the movie on the soundtrack.
The album.
And then there was a new album release that was done later in 2000, where they tried to get more of it, except they omitted some of the tracks that were on the 1997 release, and wow, substituted it with an 11-minute interview with David Arnold on the CD. So I don't know what they were thinking. These dum-dums. So there's no complete album, apparently, for this. But this is also the album that includes the Moby techno remix version of the James Bond stuff, which is not very good.
Boy. Moby coming into his own in the mid-90s.
Indeed. Well, that wraps it all up.
Yep.
Oh goodness, it's been 2 hours.
Yeah. This movie doesn't deserve this.
No. Terminate. Bail. Abort.